Sent. This cut would be devastating to WILL. Many of you have called your congressmen and senators to let them know how much you support public broadcasting. If you haven't done so, we hope you will soon. For the phone numbers of your members of Congress, call us at 217-333-1070 or visit our website, will.uiuc.edu. It's very important that Washington hear from you on whether federal funding for WILL should be cut or restored. Thanks.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Something like 5 million Americans in this country are called for jury duty every year. However, only a percentage of those people who are called actually respond. For example, here in Champaign County, for every 100 people who are called, only about 25 show up. This morning, as part of Focus 580, we'll be talking a little bit about juries, about how they are selected, and about how courts operate and the importance of people participating in that process in various and sundry ways. Particularly, we'll be looking at this question of how it is that we make juries, what can we do to make sure that juries do indeed reflect the makeup of the community. And we have here in the studio with us this morning three guests. Two of them are associated with the League of Women Voters of Champaign County, Tina Gonzalez and Joan Miller. Joan Miller chairs the Justice Committee of the League, and Tina is currently the president of the League here in Champaign County. She is also adjunct professor of law at University of Illinois. Our third guest is Steve Beckett. He is also at the law school here at U of I. He's director of a trial advocacy program, has been an attorney here in Champaign-Urbana for a long time. We will, at least to start out here, talk a little bit about a court-watching project that involves both people from the League and students from the University of Illinois. Has been going on now for a number of years. And I'll talk a little bit about what they have found as they have watched trial proceedings here in Champaign County. Questions are certainly welcome, as always, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one's good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, if you'd like to give us a call, you are certainly welcome to do that. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Maybe we might start, as you suggest, talk a little bit about the Court Watching Project. Now, certainly there are projects like this various other places around the country. The League here in Champaign County has been doing this now for quite a few years, and then a little bit more recently, I guess I use recent in relative terms, U of I students, law students have become involved. Let's start out first talking a little bit about what court watching is.
Okay, court watching is an effort to be involved in the community. What happens at the courthouse usually is unseen by the rest of the community, but it's felt by crime affects all of us. And people coming back from the justice system, from the penitentiaries, certainly have an impact on our society. When we court watch, we're taking advantage of the fact that in our society, the courts are open to the public. And so we're availing ourselves of that right to make our courts open. What we look for are fairness. We ask, is the justice system truly dispensing justice? Efficiency, are the cases moving through the system in a timely manner, and is there room for improvement? And I think this is where the project that we participated in this year helped us. We look at, is there room for improvement? And there are areas that we found there was room for improvement.
Mm-hmm. So basically the idea is to have a kind of a regular organized effort for people who are not involved in the cases at all, to simply sit in the courtroom and watch how things go and pay attention to how people conduct themselves, how the trial moves, just as a way of kind of watching, keeping an eye on what's going on.
Yeah. Well, one of the things about the League's project, and Joan is chair of our Justice Committee, and our Champaign County League has, we believe, the longest consistent court-watching project in the state of Illinois going back more than two decades. Our records are a little unclear. And like many volunteer organizations, the League is finding that there aren't as many people with as much time as there were before our societal changes that brought more people into the workplace and changed the composition of volunteer organizations. So the collaboration with the law school, where the law students actually have an educational reason for being there, is a very positive thing for all of us, we find.
Mm-hmm.
So the educational value I recognized right away when I came on greater percentage of the time at the law school in 93 and now full time, that I'm trying to teach students trial skills. I'm trying to teach students to be persuaders. I'm trying to teach students to have meaningful relationships with their clients and making sure their clients understand their rights and all that sort of thing. What better way to do it than as one of the components of the educational process to have them go to the courthouse and actually watch what's happening, what's going on, to see the good lawyers, the not-so-good lawyers, the good judges, the other judges, although I'm not commenting on any specific judges. But the you understand the idea is that if there's a breakdown in the system, I think it's good to have a student see that because I think they learn from that breakdown as well, just as they learn when everything flows smoothly.
How much time is spent by observers, that is, the people who are doing it, how much time do they spend in the courtroom?
My students have a fall semester requirement of 12 hours court watching each, so that if I have 130 students and they each must watch 12 hours, that's a lot of hours. I think we totaled up these numbers, and it's like 200 court days.
200 full-time days, 208 hour days.
Of watching court. That's a lot of court watching.
And does the individual student, do they sit in for an entire – I mean, how do they do that? Do they sit through an entire day?
They have classes, and so they have to come in segments. I think one of the things – I mean, this is historically what Joan and I have been doing for years. Joan would come and train my students in the fall. She'd tell them what's going on in each courtroom, and I would send them off to the courthouse to watch. And they had jury – hours that they had to turn in, and they had regular hours that they turn in. So pretty much they would go around from courtroom to courtroom asking judges and bailiffs others what's going on today to try to find something perhaps that was interesting. Because let's face it, watching all-day small claims court could be like watching paint dry. There aren't any lawyers in there, and so it doesn't really serve my purpose, my educational purpose. So I think one of the things that Tina brought to what Joan and I had been doing was this sense of organization and sending students to the right place at the right time to observe something that we could then record and get meaningful data out of.
Actually, the league has a very small number of court watchers. There are maybe two of us, and we try and spend our time watching jury trials. You can waste a lot of time at the courthouse because the trials go away, they plead, and then there's not a case. So that's why it's helped so much to have the students. I mean, the students saw the same things that I saw, but when 150 people see the same thing that you see, there's more validity. For instance, I observed that there were very few African Americans in the jury pool. A large number of students saw that, and that made it very meaningful to us. I saw closed-circuit arraignments where the defendants were at the court, at the jail, and their attorneys were in the courtroom with the judge, and often the defendants didn't understand the proceedings, and there was nobody there to answer their questions. When 150 students see that and comment on it, that is very meaningful.
Yeah. There's two aspects of what the students do, I think, that's really an asset to this project. One is that the students actually feel that in addition to the observation and the educational value that they get from it, that they're part of some larger process that's making the justice system better. They feel that they're actually not only getting their own, spending their time there, but they feel part of a larger whole. And it feels like a positive thing to them, which is, I think, a helpful thing for all of us. And then they fill out a structured form that all of our court watchers use, so that then this year we had collaboration from Adam Martinsik's statistics class, and they actually did the statistical analysis for us. And we had worked with some other folks from the university in looking at the instrument that collects data to make sure that we'd be getting statistically valid data. So we feel that we have a lot of redundancy in our data because often there's more than one student in the courtroom at the same time or one of our other court watchers is there, so we can do internal reliability checks. And the conclusions that we're drawing based on the observations and the data that we have, we feel pretty firm that we can stand on. And we're we're pleased that we can make observations that can help make things better.
Let me introduce very quickly again the guest we have for this first hour, Focus 580, and we'll continue to talk. We have in studio with us Tina Gonzalez, Steve Beckett, and Joan Miller. Tina Gonzalez is president of the League of Women Voters of Champaign County. She's also adjunct professor of law at the University of Illinois. Steve Beckett also teaches at U of I Law School, has been an attorney here in Champaign-Urbana for many years. He directs the trial advocacy program at the law school, and Joan Miller chairs the Justice Committee of the League of Women Voters here in Champaign County. We're talking a little bit about the court watching project that the League has been involved in a long time now with in conjunction with students at the U of I Law School. Questions are welcome here, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Well, can you give us an overview? And I understand that this is an ongoing project, a continuum project, because you want to continue to try to learn more and perhaps follow up on some of the initial conclusions that you have. But having said that, give us a little overview about what you think is most important that you have learned as a result of having these students and League members sitting in the courtroom and watching trials.
Well, I think the overall conclusions are that our observers in their sort of organized, structured court watching have the sense that once people get to the courthouse, once they get on a jury, once they get into our courtrooms, our proceedings treat people respectfully and with dignity and fairly, that we have the things that Joan talked about that are some shortcomings and structural issues that we believe could be corrected, how the video arraignment system works, some of the translation issues. But we also saw a significant discrepancy between the demographics of the Champaign-Urbana area, the county from which the jury pool is drawn, and the people who show up at the courthouse. We don't know why that is, and we have one of our next phases, in addition to continuing the structured court watching, is to do the League is taking on a study of the jury system in Champaign County. We don't know if it's the way we call jurors. We don't know if it's the database from which people are called, because we have a county with very high transients in the population. We don't know what this problem is, but there's a pretty significant discrepancy when the population of Champaign-Urbana is about 17% African-American, the county's about 11% African-American, and our jury pools are about 6% on an observed basis.
Hmm. We see not just that we see that African-Americans are underrepresented in the jury pool and in the staff of the courthouse. The judges and the attorneys are overwhelmingly Caucasian. I think that this tells us that we need to look further into the way that the jury pool is constituted, and it may well be that it's not just African Americans who are underrepresented, but that it's low-income people. And this is something you wouldn't know by seeing. And so I welcome this study that one of our members is going to be doing of the jury system, because I think it will result in our making recommendations to improve the system and to make it more representative of the total community. Hmm.
It seems to me that there is a basic problem that you find a lot of places around the country, and that is getting anybody to show up for jury duty. Now, I cited this figure, and I read it, and I'm assuming that that's correct. I read it in an article, and I think maybe it was actually came from Tina. I don't know, that here in Champaign County.
It came from representatives within the court system.
Okay. So that the response rate here in Champaign County was about 25%.
That's correct. And you have to understand the process is that once the group of jurors, the veneri that is selected by a random computer program, it generates juror summons. Well, a summons is an order of the court telling that person, show up on this date at this time. And what the judges have told us that they've learned over their experience, if they need 100 jurors, then they need to summons 400, because that's what will happen statistically. I guess part of the issue is, well, couldn't you do something? Couldn't you enforce the summons? Mm-hmm. Anecdotally, we hear of a story of Judge Baker in federal court when federal jurors did not show up, and he sent the marshal out to bring them in the following Monday to determine why they shouldn't be held in contempt of court for ignoring the court order to show up. I'm not sure that systematically that's something that you would want to do. because you want the jurors coming into the courthouse to decide these cases in the framework of an open mind, loving and accepting the system as one of the benchmarks and hallmarks of our society. And if you've enforced a summons in that way, I'm not exactly sure that's what you'll end up getting. But obviously, systematically, there's something wrong, and there are all kinds of things that could happen depending upon how the summons are responded to.
Is Champaign County exceptional in this, or do you find this the same issue of just a percentage of the people who are called actually report for duty?
We haven't done a comprehensive study. We're looking a little bit at what numbers are out there. It appears that the low response rate at varying levels is something that a lot of court systems are seeing. One of the things that's perplexing to us is that ours seems low, perhaps at the low end of the range that people are seeing. And since the pool from which these random computer drawings are made is voter registration, you could understand how that might be skewed in one way or another. Driver's licenses, identification cards offered by the Secretary of State, those pools don't seem like they ought to be skewed. But we need to look in and see. We need, in our next project, one of the things we need to do is look at those lists and see how the demographics of those match the population. In addition to, is there something about in our county because of the high mobility rate, maybe the addresses in our database are particularly bad. So maybe we're sending out a lot of summonses to people who don't live there anymore, who simply don't get them. We just don't know if it's that or if it's something else. Mm-hmm. We do know that our two-week jury terms in this county, where you're called for service for a two-week period, you can other counties in Illinois use different forms where people have perhaps shorter periods of service or one trial. Where if you could imagine, and we don't know, we'll study it, you could imagine that for the self-employed, for the hourly employees, people who are not on salary, who are not going to get paid anyway, that the two-week jury term might impose a severe economic hardship, and that might skew our day. We just don't know. So those are some of the things we'll be looking at.
Yeah. I served on a jury twice, and I found it a fascinating experience, and that's how I became interested in court watching. At the same time, it is very restrictive because you don't know, you can't make any plans for 2 weeks. I mean, it's a long period of time. Some of the things, though, that we could look at, I mean, we could look at census tract data and see whether it's low-income people or middle-income people who are not reporting for jury duty. Something that we have to think about is loss of wages, particularly, you know, if you're on call for 2 weeks, particularly for low-income people on, you know, with minimum wage, and also people that are suspicious of the courts, that are fearful of the courts may not be reporting. So there's a lot that we need to find out.
Hmm. We have a caller here. Let's bring him into the conversation. Nearby Belgium, the community, nearby Danville, line number 4 right here. Hello.
Good morning, folks. Having been on the other side of this many, many, many times, it's an interesting thing to deal with. I've been on jury duty 6 or 7 times now. The last one, matter of fact, for the last several of them, I refused to do it, which meant that I was usually punished in the back of the courtroom. I've had the police come out and pick me up once, but that time it was because I didn't get the summons. It was the mail department there. I'm self-employed. It is very, very difficult. The first couple times I served, I did actually sit through trials, and I noticed that there were some serious problems with the things that were being done, and I really had problems with it. So I tell them I cannot be fair and impartial, which judges do not like to hear at all. They question you. They give you a very stern looks and usually make you sit in the back of the courtroom to prove that there is fair and impartiality in the whole situation. And then there's the pay situation, because when I first started doing it, you were on it for a month. And my wife, who's a school teacher, who would like to be on it, has never served once. We both vote every election, and we are both drivers. We cannot figure out for the life of us why I always have to show up, and she never does.
You know, actually, that's since we've been doing this court watching and we've been writing about this, I would say that's the most frequent response I've gotten from people in social situations and walking around. where people will say, why does somebody I know get called repeatedly and I've never been called? I mean, I'm a good example. I'm a registered voter in this community. I vote reliably every election. I've lived at the same address for 25 years. I haven't been called for jury service since I was in law school.
Me either. I'm in my I'll be 57. I've never been called. I've been here forever. Never been called.
You've never been called?
Never been called.
Once?
Never, not once.
So, you know, I served on a jury when I was in law school, but I haven't been called since then. So, you know, the fact that it is random, the fact that the pool is very large for the entire county does mean that you're going to see these discrepancies. But well, the most frequent response that we've gotten, I think, since we've been writing and talking about this is, why have I never been called or why do I get called all the time? And I think it has to do with randomness.
But one of the points that I feel the caller is making is that there's something about the way the system has functioned and his participation in the system that makes him feel like he doesn't want to participate. And that's a concern that we have as well.
That's absolutely precise, sir. And let me point out even farther in this situation. And as I've pointed out to the jurist that I've dealt with, that my entrenchment in the situation, not really wanting to be in it, can be very detrimental to both sides of the case. Because having sat on juries, I notice it's very easy to sway your friends if you really want to in fellow citizenry. And so it's not really fair to either side, either the prosecution or the defense, to have somebody that's upset with the system, if you see what I'm saying.
Yeah, I agree.
You know, and especially when the judge would say, well, I question the fact that you say you cannot be fair and impartial. Well, that's one of the first questions they ask you in the jury box, is can you be fair and impartial? If you say no, they should say, good day, sir. But that's not usually what they do.
My only experience in court watching has been in Champaign County, and I found that the judges have been very respectful of prospective jurors, and when somebody has indicated that they didn't think that they were fair, they could be fair, they've been dismissed from that jury with no recrimination. No, it was accepted that and understood.
That's been my experience as well.
Well, there must be maybe a difference in the community here because, see, we're over here in Vermilion County. Vermilion County is a fairly large county, but it's a very smallly populated county. Not the smallest, I'm sure, but there's only one town in it that's now 30,000, which means you're going to have fewer and fewer people to draw from.
Yeah.
And there's the rural community is much more unpopulated than it used to be. So, you know, maybe that's why they push hard to keep every juror they can get, because you say they're only 25% show up in the first place. And then one guy says, I'm not going to do it because I can't be fair and impartial. They say, wait a minute. But just a personal experience.
All right. Well, thanks for the comment. Well, that, again, raises this issue of, for someone like this, somebody who's self-employed, he's saying that one of the issues is economic hardship. And that's one of the things that that Joan mentioned and Tina mentioned, that may indeed be one of these reasons that people are not showing up or people might not be willing to serve. Other than perhaps making the term of service shorter, is there anything that you can do about that? I mean, we're not going to be in a position to replace lost income of jurors for the time that they're serving.
About the only thing you could do would be to increase the per diems. But, you know, in point of fact, I'm also on the county board, and I know that our budget – is so tight, it would be very, very difficult. We have a budget amendment just about every year from circuit court, especially in a very trial active year, because it's hard to anticipate the number of jury trials you're actually going to have during a year. So I think the odds of jurors being paid $50 a day just is not going to happen.
What are they paid now?
$10.
$10 a day.
Plus mileage.
Did you want to add anything to that?
No, I mean, the we're looking at our league's project is preparing to look at how our juries called in other counties, particularly in Illinois, because mm-hmm. it appears to us that there are some other systems in place that increase the diversity of the jury pool without financial implications or at least huge ones.
Do you have some kind of a sense about how many people would not report, not because it would cause financial hardship, but because they don't care. They just don't think that it's important.
We'd have no way of measuring that. I mean, you literally would have to do some sort of study of the group that didn't show up. to assume that, that, and I don't know how you do it, in focus groups or sending out legions of surveyors with questionnaires if you could get those people to respond.
Do you have some thought about that, John?
Yes, I've sat in on the jury commission, and when you're called to serve jury duty, you have the, if you think that you can't serve or you would not want to serve for any particular reason, you have the option of appearing before the jury commission and stating the reason. A lot of teachers will ask not to serve during the school year but serve during the summer, and people who are caring for somebody who's ill or caring for a young child or people who are self-employed. And for legitimate reasons, you can be excused, and I've found those people, again, like the judges, to be very respectful. And it's often a person's first experience with the court system, and it turns out to be a very positive one. So you don't have to serve if there's a reason why you can't.
It's entirely possible that another part of the task is to do a better job of education about what the role of jury service is in our democracy, about the fact that, I mean, again, anecdotally, you talk to people who say, oh, I was called for jury duty. I thought this was going to be horrible. You know, it was actually a really good experience, and I learned a lot from it, and I was really pleased that I'd done it, which is another one of the responses that we've gotten pretty frequently as we've been writing and talking about this. So it may be that we need to do a better job of talking about this. I mean, one of the things when we were getting ready to start writing about this is we did a little research and discovered that not only is the jury system fundamental to the American system of democracy, it's practically a distinguishing characteristic because we learned that 95% of the world's jury trials are held in the United States.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There are some people who get an automatic exemption. For example, newspaper reporters get an automatic exemption. Broadcast reporters do not. I don't know what the difference is. Physicians, I believe, medical doctors do. I'm not sure who all else. Is there been any discussion at any level of government about whether or not you need to actually have those people just automatically excused?
Actually, the number of exemptions has been pared down dramatically in recent years. I think lawyers, clergymen, I can't remember the laundry list. Even when I was in law school a few years ago, the exemptions were much broader. And now I think they are very narrow, very narrow. I think the newspaper folks, I think competency, people who are deemed not to be competent, I don't remember the other categories.
All right. But still, the print reporters.
I didn't mean to encapsulate the news reporters and the incompetency in the same sentence.
We have several callers here. Let's get back to the people who are listening. Next up, someone in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Yeah, hi. Mm-hmm. You know, with all the shenanigans going on with voter rolls and in Florida and whatnot, conspiracy theorist might wonder, you know, if there's some sort of sifting of these juries by political inclinations.
Well, we certainly don't have that. I think part of it could be a lack of knowledge, a lack of educational understanding. You know, in Illinois, if you've been convicted of a felony, you can still register to vote. You can still serve on a jury. Now, it may be a person who has that in their background feels that they don't trust the court system or that they might not be selected, and so they wouldn't come forward when they got their summons. But they are not disenfranchised, and they're not excused for cause from a jury system because they have a prior conviction. I don't know. I don't know if that's a reason why someone would stay away.
What's due to the lack of knowledge?
Well, that people out in the community think that if, for instance, they might think that because I have a conviction, or they might think because someone in my family has had a conviction, that I shouldn't come forward, because the first thing the judge is going to do is ask me, has anybody in your family ever been convicted of a crime? I'm going to have to say yes. Therefore, I'm automatically not going to be selected for a jury. And that's not true.
The selection process definitely should not be completely random. There should be – oh, hold on just one second. There should be some process where anyone who's served in on a jury recently should be given a lower probability of being selected, and anyone who has not been – has not served in a long time should have a higher probability, even if you make it partially random.
So a weighted randomness.
It's absolutely, positively. There should be some kind of weighting where, there's a greater chance of everybody serving at some time or another. And, not only would that be more fair and evenly distributed among the population, it would just bring people together in the community more, because instead of, one person being jealous of another person because they got to serve on jury duty, and the other person being jealous of the other person because they didn't have to serve, every couple of months, instead of both people feeling bad and alienated from each other, both people would feel good that they got to participate, but not too much, and then they could swap, war stories over the water cooler.
Yeah. Well, that certainly would get at the issue raised by the very first caller, where he said he's been called repeatedly, that his wife hasn't been called at all. And I think Tina said, yes. And in fact, when you talk to people, that's the kind of thing that you hear all the time. You have people say, I've been called a whole bunch of times, and my next door neighbor hasn't been called at all. So, is there in some way to deal with that?
I was in court one time when the judge asked the jurors, have any of you been called again within a period of 6 months? And there was one woman, and this was her second time within 5 months of being called for jury duty, and he offered to excuse her, but she wanted to serve.
Hmm. Well, I think it's one of the things, as our project goes forward to study how the system operates, I think it's one of the solutions or one of the recommendations that need to be examined in terms of, have other jurisdictions tried this? How has it worked? How hard is it to implement? And I think there are a lot of questions, and we don't have good answers for them yet, but we have the first step, which is the observations and the structured court watching going on that is allowing us to collect some organized and statistically meaningful data, and then we'll build on the next step by studying it some more.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's talk with someone else. The next caller will be in Champaign. This is line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hello. I've been in the community 55 years, and I've only served once. But it wasn't a very happy situation for me. I was very upset. We were trying a case, and I was surprised that they allowed an ex-sheriff on the jury. But anyhow, after we heard everything, we went into the jury room. He just sort of took over, said he'd been on lots of juries and he could help us. And the first thing he did was gather all the men, men only, in the corner. And the only thing I heard was, we want to support our police, which means he'd already made the decision for us. And they whispered around for a while. Then he came back, he took charge, and he said, now we'll vote for who will be foreman, and we were each supposed to put our own name on a piece of paper and pass it in. And lo and behold, he became the foreman. And then he saw a few of us, there were three women, being a little surprised. And so he said, oh, all right, we'll do it again. And we each had to put our name on a piece of paper, and he was the foreman again. I had wondered, but was inexperienced in all this, if he had asked all the men to put his name on it. Then the voting, it was pretty much the men against three women. And then the case lasted the second day, and we were told not to discuss it with anybody. And the first thing that happened when we got back is one of the women said she talked it over with her husband, and he said that she was to vote guilty. And this surprised me because I didn't know that husbands who weren't even there were, part of the jury. Is there anything that could have caused this to be a mistrial? What should I have done? I was very upset.
I suppose the reporting to the presiding judge about the juror who had talked about the case with her husband could be considered juror misconduct. The dynamic of the jury, once it begins to deliberate, however, is pretty much left up to its own. So you could have someone with an extremely strong personality who could literally take over a jury in that dynamic. I mean, I guess my reaction is I wish my law students could hear this story. Those who are wanting to practice criminal defense might say, well, be careful about leaving someone on the jury because they have a certain number of peremptory challenges who's in law enforcement. And the prosecutors would go, yes, we should leave on people who've formerly been in law enforcement.
Is it all right to be in the jury room and have little groups chatting among themselves?
No.
To the exclusion of others?
No. All the deliberations should include all the jurors, and jurors are warned by the judge routinely not to discuss the case with anybody, including other jurors, until you go into the jury room to deliberate. And so,
would this have made it a mistrial?
Well, I think if you had a concern, if this happened to you again, you could tell the bailiff about your concern, and he would relay that to the judge. I had a very similar experience on one of the juries that I served, and on a milder level than yours. And I think sometimes it's very emotional because we all bring into it our own personalities and our biases, and not every jury experience is a happy one. There are some that are very positive, others that aren't.
Mm-hmm. Well, even on the elevator, one of the people said he wanted to know who the juror was, who I had originally hung it because I was just angry. And I think the only thing I had in my possession was to hang the jury. And the judge refused it and made us keep on deliberating until we came to a verdict, and I finally gave in. But it was very upsetting to me.
Well, I appreciate you calling in
Thank
and giving
you
us this
much.
Story. And just again, Steve, it sounds as if the what happens in the jury room once the jury goes
once
in.
Once they receive the case,
no one tells them.
Well, that dynamic within the room is the way that group functions. And I suppose there's a psychology of small group functioning that you could do there. But of course, they're left there. They can't, if they're excused for the evening and go home, which is the way, seems to be the way to do it. We don't have sequestered juries, at least in Champaign County, anymore. The judge admonishes, just as Joan said, you're not supposed to talk about this case with anyone. You're not supposed to go home and talk to your husband or significant other or, you know, anybody else about the case. It's supposed to be those 12 people who are reviewing the evidence and deciding the case, and that would be considered juror misconduct.
Yeah. Let's continue. We have about 10 minutes left, about 15 minutes left. Maybe I should also introduce again our guest. Steve Beckett teaches at the University of Illinois Law School. He directs the Trial Advocacy Program, also has practiced law in Champaign-Urbana for many years. Joan Miller chairs the Justice Committee of the Champaign County League of Women Voters. And Tina Gonzalez is president of the Champaign County League. She is also adjunct professor of law at University of Illinois. We've been talking a bit about the Champaign County Court Watching Project, which has been going on for a long time, that involves the League and also law students from the U of I. Questions, comments, welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We'll go back over to Danville for another listener here, right here, line number 4. Hello.
Yes, thank you. Mm-hmm. Excellent discussion this morning. Something that I think that needs to be talked about at this point, because throughout this entire conversation, there's been a number of issues that I think can be addressed by this one singular right. You know, we talked about helplessness and jurors not feeling like they have any power, juries being hijacked by individuals. We're talking about the education of the students, but in none of this discussion have we been talking about the education of the public. And the education of the public to address a lot of these issues would be to educate them about juror rights, also known as jury nullification. Jury nullification empowers an individual who have actually more powers than Congress or the President, because they can nullify any law.
Well, actually, that would be unlawful. And when you become a juror, you take an oath, and the oath is to uphold the laws and Constitution of the United States. I'm not saying that jury nullification doesn't occur, but as a matter of fact, jurors don't have the right to nullify the law.
Under what statute?
Under any statute. That's why there's a juror oath, that you will uphold the laws of the state of Illinois and the Constitution of the state of Illinois and the Constitution of the United States. You know, you can't have jurors who say, well, I don't care that the prosecution has proved the elements of homicide, of murder. I like this guy, I'm going to let him go. You know, you just, you can't do that. Or this was a horrible investigation. It was brought with evil purpose by the complaining witness. And even though the state has proved its case, we're going to let him go. That, you know, that just doesn't, that doesn't make any sense.
But you haven't answered my question.
Well, I think I have answered your question.
Under what statute, under what law, does it nullify a juror's right to uphold the Constitution?
Okay.
The Constitution is based upon the juror's right to be able to try.
You didn't listen to me. The statute is the statute that sets forth how jurors are selected, jurors' duties, and the juror's oath. You can't have an oath. You know, you don't take an oath that says, sometimes I'm going to follow the law, sometimes I'm going to follow the Constitution. The oath says you're going to follow the law.
So we as jurors have no rights once we're on that jury.
You have a right. You have a right to determine the facts. You have a right to exercise your own judgment. You have a right to follow the rules of law that apply to trials. And you don't have to agree with the government's witnesses, for instance, in a criminal case. You don't have to agree with the defense's witnesses. You have a right to believe what you feel the evidence has produced. But you don't have a right. You know, we don't live in an anarchistic society. This isn't, you know, some hectic chaos where we just pick 12 people off the street and they get to do whatever they want. That's the whole point of having a jury.
Didn't jurors originally have this right?
No, they've never had that right.
They've never had this right?
They have not. They have not. You hear about jurors, juries who've done it, runaway juries who do nullify for whatever reason. That was one of the problems in the South, because African-American defendants would be absolutely not guilty. They'd be convicted anyway because jurors were nullifying. Or white defendants who had committed crimes on African-American victims would be found not guilty. You know, there's a case going on down in Mississippi right now where there's a jury that's deadlocked, where an 80-some-year-old guy is accused of killing the civil rights workers back in the 60s. Who knows what's going on with that jury? So am I naive enough to say that there isn't nullification? No, I'm not. But to say that it's a juror right, that's just wrong.
Well, that is one of the auto exemptions, is it not, from being dismissed as a juror? Is to tell the judge that you believe in, if you're in the process of being interviewed for a jurorship.
That's correct. If you tell the judge you're not going to follow the law.
No, if you believe in the constitutional right of, if you find a law that is immoral or improper, that you have the right as a citizen under the Constitution of the United States to nullify it.
The judge is going to ask you, are you going to follow the law? If you give any indication that you will not, you'll be excused.
Thank you. That's what I was wanting to know.
All right. We'll go on. The next caller here is in Champaign. This is line number 3. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'd like to follow up in part on the last caller and in part on the caller before that. And I'm curious about the rights and responsibilities of the jury and of a person who serves on the jury. And particularly whether any of your guests there have a recommendation of a book or a guide for proper acting on a jury. In other words, what can jurors do? You've just given us some information about sort of busting some myths about jury nullification. But what about asking questions of the judge or requesting action by the court or... you know, like the caller two calls ago, if you see what you think is misconduct within the jury, how do you respond? You know, if there's a lot of questions, is there any good guide to how to be on a jury out there?
I think there's not a good guide, but you point up, as did the previous caller, the need for education. Most of us, when we get a summons to report for jury duty, what am I going to do? I mean, a lot of people are scared. I mean, I see people go to the jury commission and they're very nervous. I mean, they're actually shaking. And there really isn't a reason to worry, but you don't know that until you get there. I think as far as what you do when you're on a jury, if you see any irregularity, you are supposed to notify the judge. You can send the judge a note, or you can notify his bailiff, and he will give the information to the judge. But as far as your conduct in the as a member of the jury, you take an oath to follow the judge's instructions, and he will instruct you on what to do, when you can talk about the case, what you do if there appears to be some irregularity. So in general, we need to inform people about what to do if you're called for jury duty, and generally what you can expect when you're on a jury, but more specific instructions always come from the judge.
You know, raise an interesting point. The American Bar Association is running an initiative now on the American jury, and they have a number of educational materials they've developed. And maybe one of the things our jury project needs to do is look at those and see if some of those would be helpful resources. So that's an interesting idea, and we can add that to our list. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Let's go to another caller. This is also Champagne, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'm calling, and I guess my concern is I heard that 25% of only 25% of people who are summoned for jury duty in Champaign County actually show up. Now, have there been studies, statistical studies, to explain why that is, or is this just the reasons for this are simply gut reactions? What is the deal there?
Well, that, we don't know the answer to that, and that's one of the things that the League of Women Voters Champaign County's jury project will be undertaking in our next phase.
Okay.
We're going to continue our court watching so we continue to have the information about how the system is functioning, but we're going to start studying the questions that some of these observations have raised, and one of them is what's going on with our jury response rate. We don't know, and we have a number of questions, and we're going to try to figure out the answers.
Okay, well, that's going to segue me into a question specifically for Professor Beckett. He, in a very conspicuous way, surmised that African Americans, for example, were somewhat culprits for lacking a racially diverse jury pool because, one, they had a tendency to shirk their civic responsibilities.
No, didn't say that at all.
I read the article.
I know that, but I didn't say that. I was there. I know what I said.
Well, you know, I actually...
Well, I know what was printed. And two, that they have a misconception about what goes on at the Champaign County Courthouse. So I found that to be interesting because it also seemed to indicate he was shooting from the hip.
Well, both Steve and I talked to the reporter and then...
I don't expect seasoned attorneys and professors to shoot from the hip on something as important as race.
Sir, may I give you a piece of information that might be of assistance?
Yes, you may.
When that story was written by the reporter, there was a she had limited space, and I believe that what happened is that there had been a conversation about the low response rate to jury summons in general, and then there was some other conversation, and I think they got sort of smashed together in the writing of the article, both under deadline and space constraints. I think in retrospect, all of us would have hoped that article might have had a little more space in order to put a fuller context. That's one of the reasons we put together our guest commentary to try to put all the facts out together. None of us actually control what newspaper reporters write. I think that she was working hard to do a conscientious job, and I think she had space and time constraints. And so I think it left with some people an impression that was inaccurate about both what the study said and both the issues that we were looking at studying. And I think all of us feel bad about that because the goal is to improve the situation.
Well, that may be true, but I'm telling you, it did cause offense in a large portion of the African-American community.
Okay, and other than having told you and everybody else who's ever asked me, can you tell me how I could possibly have corrected the misimpression that was created by the article?
A follow-up article where there are
And that's why we wrote the follow-up article that was in the Sunday paper. And tried to point out specifically that we were talking about all people, not some specific segment of the community.
Damage had been done, Professor Beckett.
Okay, and like somehow that was my fault that the damage was done? It sounds like you have a preconceived notion, and no matter what the facts are, you're going to hold your opinion, and you're entitled
well,
to
I
do that.
I understand the dynamics of race in this county and this country, and I understand the dynamics of race and the so-called equity of a jury system. And whenever I see race being played fast and loose vis-a-vis the jury system, yes, I do have some concern.
We have some concerns, too, about the discrepancy between the demographics of the county and the juries that we observe at the courthouse. And that's one of the major findings of the study that we were trying to bring to light. So I guess the thing
I
that
think
I would...
if you were well-intentioned, and I have no reason to deny this, it indeed backfired. And I saw nothing, quite frankly, as of this moment, they corrected the damage that was done. But well, thank you.
Let me again raise this issue that one of the articles you're talking about was written by a newspaper reporter that we didn't control, and then the second article that we actually wrote that represented our findings, we tried to correct it by – they gave us a fair amount of space, and we tried to correct it by putting all the facts out there. And the goal is to improve the situation. And we found a significant problem. We don't understand the cause. We hope to study it. And we'd like everyone who's interested and concerned about this to join in with us.
And if people want to comment, they want to contact you, what do they do?
We put our email addresses in the newspaper commentary we wrote. Joan Miller, the League of Women Voters, has a web page that people can submit things to us. You can send us email. You can write us letters. You can call us. And we'd be delighted to have people participate in both continuing our court watching and extending our court watching project with additional people. We're looking for people in groups who would like to participate and people who are interested in participating in the jury study to make recommendations for improving the situation.
Okay. Well, we're just about the point where we're going to have to stop. I know this is something that you're going to continue to look at, and maybe on another day we'll have an opportunity to talk some more. And any last sort of thought that you would like to leave with folks?
The whole point of the study is for improvement. It's difficult to raise issues that contain criticism and have them accepted in a constructive way. Nobody's pointing any fingers. Nobody's blaming anyone about anything. We just want the system to work. We want it to work better.
All right. Well,
our full report is available online at the College of Law website. You can go and download the analysis, and we will also seek permission from the News Gazette to put our guest commentary that ran on the 29th of May. That's our full report of our project. We'll seek permission from them to be able to post that as well. So people who'd like to get the facts as we collected them can get them at the College of Law or League of Women Voters website.
And we welcome anybody in the community who wants to work with us to make the system better.
All right. Our three guests, Joan Miller, you just heard from her. She chairs the Justice Committee of the Champaign County League of Women Voters. Tina Gonzalez is president of the Champaign County League, also adjunct professor of law at the U of I. Steve Beckett directs the trial advocacy program at the U of I Law School and has been an attorney here in practice for a long time in Champaign-Urbana. Thank you all very much.
Thank you for having us.
Programming here on AM 580 made possible in part by a grant from the Thrifty Nichols American Classifieds. It's distributed each Thursday in over 100 towns in East Central Illinois on the web at AmericanClassifieds.com. The broadcast also made possible with support from Orange Taxi, a new taxi company providing services to the U of I campus and the Champaign-Urbana area 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at 367-8888. In the next part of Focus, we'll be talking with Robert O'Hara Jr. He's a reporter at the Washington Post, and we'll be talking about his recent book. It's titled No Place to Hide. It's about just how much information there is available about all of us and the way that we live our lives and how private information producers and compilers are starting to cooperate more and more with the government. And more on that in the next hour. First, though, we'll break for update on the markets and news.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by Farm Credit Service.